Hello, and welcome back to Spinal Cast. I'm your host, David Stevens, and joining us today is Dr. Murray Blackmore. Dr. Blackmore is a decorated scholar and professor at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at Marquette University, and he runs a research lab there devoted to finding a cure for spinal cord injury. Dr. Blackmore, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Awesome. So, you know, today's episode, I think our real goal is to give our audience a look into the research that you've worked on so far throughout your career, but also get your insights on some of the other research and kind of the current state of global research, all within the SCI space. And if that sounds all right to you, we'll just jump into some questions.
Let's do it.
All right. Perfect. So what originally led you to focus on kind of spinal cord injury research? What got you into it originally?
Yeah, right. I mean, I think I was always going to be a scientist of some kind, just by inclination or whatever. So I think every multiverse has me as a scientist in it somewhere. But in this universe, my mom got a spinal cord injury.
Oh, wow.
When I was 13. It was a car accident, complete cervical injury.
Wow.
So yeah, I spent some of my formative years sort of in rehab with her, met a lot of people, saw her live with the injury up close, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a straight line. Like, I explored some other kinds of science, but
okay.
In my mid twenties, I kind of had an epiphany that like this was the problem I wanted to tackle.
Yeah.
And it's been doing it ever since.
So in your research, I know you center a lot of it around kind of the nervous system, the central nervous system. And I guess, why is it so hard for the nervous system to heal after an injury similar to like what your mother experienced, you know, as compared to other parts? You know, you break a finger, bones grow back. Why does the central nervous system not have that capability?
Yeah. I mean, it's frustrating, right?
Yeah.
I mean, no one knows for sure, but I think what it really has to do with is just the state of things before the injury, right?
Mm-hmm.
So your brain, it's just so static. I mean, the neurons that you're born with outside of just a couple specialized places, that's all the neurons you get. Like your neurons don't divide, they don't replace themselves, right?
Interesting.
And like the main pathways in your brain, like they're set up, they're wired, and they're not going to change. Like the nervous system can make really small adjustments on a very local scale, meaning like less than a millimeter, it can kind of sprout and retract and so on.
Okay.
But like, look, you're not going to get new neurons and you're not going to get new pathways. But think about your skin, like your skin is turning over all the time. There's just this churn, right?
Right.
So you can see if you drop an injury into that, like your skin is just going to keep doing what it's doing, which is replacing itself. But your nervous system, it's just static. So it's a much heavier lift.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And have anybody really identified why that is, as opposed to, you know, why different systems have different approaches to things like that?
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, at a high level, if you want to get sort of abstract about it.
Yeah.
When you think about evolution,
right,
there may not be like a reason for your brain to be able to repair itself, because even if it can do it, it's so slow that there's no advantage to being able to do it. Like you're eaten before you ever recover, right?
Got it.
So there's kind of no evolutionary drive. And then there may be kind of the opposite drive, because it might be a really bad idea to make your brain so plastic, so dynamic, that it stops being able to function. Mm-hmm. So in other words, once it's wired up and once it's working, basically, maybe there's an evolutionary drive to just sort of keep it locked into place.
Yeah. If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Exactly. Like, yeah, don't mess it up, basically. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, that kind of covers the central nervous system stuff. But I also know that your lab is really focused around genetic approaches to kind of this whole injury. And studies on how, you know, gene regulation affects axon growth, which both of which I think are probably worth explaining a little bit further for the audience. But can you explain what it means in simple terms and just kind of try and give us a little bit of an understanding of kind of what it is your lab works on so specifically?
Absolutely. I'll take a crack at it. if you don't mind, I think it'll take a little time to sort of unpack those two terms. Like this might actually be a chunk of the conversation.
Oh, that sounds great.
But let's break it into pieces, right? So
yeah,
you've got axon growth and gene regulation. Let's unpack those. I'm going to start with the axon growth. All right.
Okay.
Cool. All right. So axons, I think most people know this, but, the way that neurons send signals is they send these signals on these long, long, long cables, and those are the axons. So just think of them as like long wires in the brain, basically.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And the way it works is like those things are grown in the embryo, like during development.
Got it.
So like there might be a neuron up in your brain, and that's like where the main cell is. It's where the nucleus is. It's where the DNA is. But then it has to grow this process to whatever its target is, and let's make it the spinal cord.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got to grow this axon all the way down the spinal cord. That's kind of the original axon growth, if you will.
Yeah.
And what you have to appreciate about it is just the scale of things. So here's what I like to tell my students. If your body is a neuron,
mm-hmm,
and your arm is an axon, you're talking about growing an arm that's like 6 to 10 miles long at the extreme.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's axon growth. It's this like incredible cellular process of this long extension. And the reason that matters so much is, so after a spinal cord injury, what happens is the axons get cut, obviously, in the spinal cord.
Mm-hmm.
And so any signal that's being sent down the spinal cord, it stops at the injury site.
Right.
And it's not really like a cable. That's where the analogy breaks down, because the part of the cable that's past the injury that's not connected to the cell body anymore.
Right.
It's not being supplied. So it just degenerates. It's gone.
Like almost instantaneously, or does that take some time?
It takes like a couple weeks.
Okay.
By a couple weeks, it's just gone. So you're left with this situation. So there's good news. Here's the good news. The cell body up in your brain, it's fine. It still exists.
Yeah.
The axon above the injury is pretty much fine. It exists. But the problem is now, in order to restore the connection, to restore the communication, you're asking the cell to regrow from the point of injury all the way down the spinal cord to its original target. So like if you start with an arm that's 6 miles long, you're sort of talking about cutting it off at like the 2 mile mark.
Right.
And then asking it to grow those last 4 miles again.
Right. And has there been research done, or you know, you mentioned it takes a number of weeks for that cutoff part to kind of deteriorate. But what about like trying to get in there early enough to bridge it? You know, back to the wire example, can we tether one wire to the other wire and try and get them to recommunicate? I'm assuming there's been research around that as well.
Yeah, it's a great question, especially out in they call it the peripheral nervous system, the nerves that run out, you know, in your extremities.
Mm-hmm.
People have actually tried that. I've got two problems with that approach.
Okay.
Number one, it's only going to work immediately after the injury, so it's not going to help anyone with a long-term chronic injury. So right off the bat, I'm sort of less interested for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
The other is there are literally millions of these cables running through the spinal cord.
Hmm.
And how on earth are you going to wire up the right cable to the right cable, right?
Right.
So even if you could somehow like splice them immediately, it would be chaos. There'd be just no way to line them up.
Right. And make sure that it was connected to the right one, and finding that loose tether that who knows where it wound up, that sort of thing.
Exactly. Like you're trying to move your leg and like your blood vessels are constricting, right?
Right.
Those are all signals that are coming from your brain. So,
Got it. Got it. No, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, that's when I say I'm trying to achieve axon growth, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to get these cables to regrow.
Right.
So that gets us to gene regulation. So why genes at that point?
Mm-hmm.
All right, gene regulation. I think the place to start, I'm going to start in kind of a funny place on that.
Okay.
But I'm going to make a simple point, which is that your body's got a bunch of different cells, right?
Yep.
You've got heart cells and skin cells and neurons and on and on and on. And they're all doing wildly different things. But here's the thing. They all have in their nucleus the exact same DNA.
Right.
all the cells in your body have the same DNA, but they do such different things. So how, right? Like, how is that possible?
Right.
And it's possible because each cell is taking the same DNA and it's choosing to activate different parts of the DNA, like use these regions and turn off these regions.
Mm-hmm.
And by picking and choosing across all the available DNA, cells can do amazingly different things, right?
Right.
And so I think it's that. So you have to think about a neuron that's been injured. It's lost part of its axon. And what you're asking it to do is make this transition from homeostasis, right? Like just kind of a neuron living its life and sending its signals.
Yeah.
To switching to a mode where it's building this long, 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 long process.
Yeah.
And I think in order to do that, it's such a fundamental cellular transition that you have to be looking at a massive shift in gene expression and the actual parts of the DNA that the cell is using to use.
Right.
And so that's really it in a nutshell. What I think we got to do in order to convince an injured neuron to regrow its axon is, I forgot to say the most important thing. There are many neurons in nature that do this successfully, that make this transition successfully.
Oh, okay.
Right? So there are neurons that live in your spinal cord and just outside of your spinal cord that send these long axons out into your arms and legs.
Yeah.
And if you cut those axons, those cells will transition back into a growth mode. And they will regrow their axons successfully, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And the same is true like in fish, and their spinal cords, they can regrow axons after injury. So like this can be done is the point. Like this transition is doable.
Yeah.
It's just that the neurons in our brain that get injured after a spinal cord injury, they don't do it.
Got it. Has there ever been the thought of introducing kind of a new component that is just designed to do the growing? I'm trying to think of a good kind of like layman example of what I'm imagining. But if you have this nucleus in this cell and you can't get the nucleus to do what you want, is there any chance you could bring in a new nucleus and kind of install it at the end where you need it to grow and say, all right, from here, grow on. I don't know if that's making sense. But that's where my brain would naturally go.
It is. I'd love how you're thinking. You're thinking, okay, you've got a system and the system has a constraint. And we know this: the constraint can be overcome because other cells do it, but this cell doesn't.
Right.
So what can we add into the cell? What sort of new component can we add that could achieve the growth that we want, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So that's gene therapy, right?
Got it.
In other words, might there be genes that are normally either missing or inactive in the neuron that's not growing an axon that we can artificially add in to convince it to start growing?
Right.
And yeah, exactly. That's the core concept. That's what we do in the lab.
Very cool. Very cool. I have a note here to talk about biomaterials. Do you want to kind of jump into that now and kind of give us a little understanding of what the importance of those things are and kind of, you know, a little background on those?
Yeah, a little bit. It's a detour, but I think it's worthwhile because I'm going to start with this point. What we do in the lab is we try to convince neurons to ramp up their ability to grow an axon.
Right.
Great. That is, I think, essential. But it's one piece of the puzzle. So when you look at spinal cord injury from a scientific point of view, you have to think in terms of a puzzle with a bunch of different pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And the pieces have to fit together. And if you only have one piece or even two pieces, you probably can't move the system that far.
Right.
So biomaterials is really a chance to sort of stop talking about what my lab does and kind of put it in the broader context.
Ah, got it.
Yeah. And so the broader context here is a really simple point. If you have a severe spinal cord injury like my mom had, you have an actual cavity, like an actual hole in the cord almost always.
Yeah.
Right? So there's like tissue and the tissue is broken down and there's just like fluid filled space in the middle of that hole.
Interesting.
There's a little bit spared around the edges. So there's still like some connections around the edges, but you've got a hole and it gets worse. It's not just a hole. it's a hole that's lined by scar tissue.
Right.
That's it's there to stop the injury from spreading. It's there to stop bacteria from getting into the spinal cord. But it also has the effect of like blocking the axons from growing.
Right.
So you can see how, like, even if my lab is wildly successful and we ramp up the growth ability of the neurons, it won't matter if they're faced with a scar and on the far side of the scar is empty space, right?
Mm-hmm.
So where the biomaterials come in is you're going to have to put something into the cord for the axons to grow on.
Got it.
And that something could be cells, and a lot of people use cells, but there's also these kind of exciting developments of it could be an artificial material with all these really cool properties.
Interesting.
That could facilitate the axon growth.
Got it.
Yeah.
So basically, like, the toolkit that the axon needs to basically go through with what you're asking it to do. Here are all the materials that you need to go and build the rest of this axon. You're providing it basically with those materials.
Yeah, close. It's actually easiest to understand by an analogy, I think.
Okay.
All right. Imagine a bunch of broken down. Imagine a bunch of broken down cars.
Okay.
In front of a bridge that's fallen down.
Yeah.
Right. And you want to get the cars across the bridge. It's pretty clear you're going to have to do two things. One, you're going to have to fix the cars. You got to put on new tires and give them engines, right?
Right.
Fix the motor, whatever. But they're going to need a bridge. You're going to have to rebuild that bridge.
Yeah.
Right. The biomaterials are the bridge.
Got it.
They're the things you put into the injury site so that once the cars are running, they can proceed.
Got it. Got it. Very cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then how, you know, with these genes and combinations that you guys have been working on, how do those actually help the neurons do this effort of regrowing? What, like, how are your implants able to kind of convince them, now we got to start doing something again?
Yeah, that it's a great question. What we do in a nutshell is, it starts with this. So it starts with a reverse engineering problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to come back to this again and again. There are so many examples in nature of neurons that successfully grow their axons.
Yeah.
That really what they're in the business of doing is figuring out how exactly do they do that.
Right.
And there's a couple explanations. One is, now I've got to use a science term again.
Go for it.
Apologies in advance.
No, I love it.
The term is transcription factor.
Okay.
So it's just this term. It's a name for a protein in the cell that goes into the nucleus and it sits on DNA. And it sort of makes the decision for the cell of whether that region of DNA is going to be active or inactive.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that cells that are going to go on to regrow their axons,
yeah,
have very specific transcription factors that are active. And we think what those transcription factors are doing is they're going into the nucleus, interacting with a bunch of genes, turning on the cellular material that the cell needs to grow its axon.
Got it.
And then, great, you're off and running.
Right.
And so to answer your question, one of our main lines of research, sort of one of the two main lines at this point, is identifying the transcription factors that the successful regenerators use, artificially sending those into neurons that normally don't grow, and then trying to induce growth that way.
Got it. So in the research that you've done up to this point, I know you've mentioned that there's numerous animals, or I should say kind of nature proving that this is capable. Of all of those findings, has there been one that's like, this is exactly what we need to replicate? And that, you know, maybe the other ones are also doing something very similarly, maybe, but it's not quite apples to apples. Is there anything that, like, you feel like this is the perfect example of what we're trying to accomplish?
So, no, but it's okay, and I'll tell you why.
Okay.
So first, I'll tell you why there isn't. Here's the challenge you run into. We can pick any comparison. Let's just use those peripheral neurons, the ones that live in your spinal cord, but their axons go into the periphery.
Yeah.
And they can regenerate. So there's these beautiful data sets. So here's the beautiful thing. We're living in kind of this golden age where our ability to look inside the cell and see exactly what genes are on and exactly what genes are off and how that changes through time, we've never had a clearer picture. It's amazing. And so these data sets are pouring in that kind of describe these different instances of successful regeneration.
Right.
So awesome. So now you've got your example. Like here's this neuron and it's growing its axon, what genes are on and what genes are off.
Right.
And then you can compare the genes that are on and off to the same thing that we get from the neurons that aren't growing the axon. That's the good news. Where the problem comes in is you're going to get this long, long list of genes that are different between the two conditions.
Mm.
And some of those differences are totally relevant and explain the difference in axon growth. And most of those differences are just different because it's like two different cell types, like
right.
doing completely different things. So there might be 2,000 genes that are different, but only a small subset are relevant. So any one comparison, there's too much noise in the signal.
Right.
But you can see where I'm going with this. What you do, and this is what's so cool, and it's what we're doing, and it's what I'm so excited about right now, is you go on to your next example. You say, okay, well, now let's look at some fish neurons.
Right.
And they can regrow their axons. And you can look at all their genes. And again, you're going to get this massive list of differences, and most of those differences are just like, well, it's a fish, it's not a mammal, so it's different, right?
Right.
But some of those differences are actually going to be very similar to the differences you saw in that peripheral difference, right? So now you can intersect the two and you can sort of like, what's the same in the differences? Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah.
And what's cool is you can keep going. Every time someone profiles a new cell type that can regenerate, you can look at those differences, line them up with the ones you already have, and your list gets tighter and tighter and tighter and tighter.
Correct.
Until, and what I think we've got now is a set of a couple hundred genes that truly explain and divide a regenerating neuron from a non-regenerating neuron.
Wow.
So we kind of like...
You say a couple hundred, like out of what? Like, are we talking trillions, millions? Like how many genes are we narrowed down to 100 from?
Beautiful. There's about 30,000-ish protein-coding genes in the genome.
Okay.
And so of those, I think about 200 are probably playing some role in explaining the difference between success and failure with axon growth.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very small percentage. It's a little surprising that it's that few that are actually playing a role in something as major as that.
Yeah. And to be clear, I think there's many, many more that play a role that like modulate one way or another.
Okay.
But kind of like at the core, if you really want to explain can't grow versus can grow.
Yeah.
I think it's those 200 that kind of set that basic ability.
Very cool. Well, I mean, obviously it sounds like you're making, you know, broad strides in the research that you're doing, but are there any kind of breakthroughs that we're approaching in the near future or, you know, major things that are, you know, on the road for you and your research team?
Yeah, I want to just highlight one thing. It's a thing that I'm most excited about right now.
Yeah.
And it starts with what was initially, I think, surprising and disappointing. So I'll tell you the story real quick.
Okay.
We started with a deceptively simple question. We know that the neurons in the brain that we care about that send their axons to the spinal cord don't regenerate after an injury.
Correct.
What we didn't know is like, what do the neurons do after an injury? Meaning what genes actually go up and down?
Mm-hmm.
Like what's the natural injury response? And with new technology, kind of for the first time, we're able to really dive into that question. And we were very excited. What we thought we were going to find was that there might be some inappropriate response to injury that's blocking these growth pathways, for instance.
Right.
So we did a simple experiment. You injure a neuron and you look at its gene activity and you compare it to before the injury. And what we found was something really surprising to us at the time. The neurons basically don't respond.
Hmm.
Their gene activity after the injury looks almost identical to their gene activity before the injury. It's like they either don't know or don't care that they've been injured at all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They're still staying status quo, even though a major shift has taken place.
Yep, exactly.
Which is unlike a lot of the other, I'm assuming, systems in the body.
Exactly. And especially these other examples I keep bringing up of neurons that do regenerate. What they do is they see an injury to their axon. They undergo this massive cellular stress response.
Interesting.
Which is looks like it's really conserved through evolution. It's like the same set of genes kind of sets off this cascade where the cell becomes massively stressed, and then it resolves that stress by repairing the axon.
Mm.
But the neurons in our brain, and now I think we know why, it's one, the injury is so far away from the neuron, and two, the neuron has all these other connections that it makes along the way to the spinal cord.
Yeah.
And those are still intact.
Right.
So basically the injury signal either doesn't get back to the cell body or the cell body doesn't respond. So it's a very, very muted response to the injury.
Interesting.
And yeah, it's not just interesting. It is, I think, one of the keys here.
Yeah.
Because so now we know two things. Neurons that can regenerate initiate a massive cellular stress response.
Right.
We know that that stress response is essential for the axon growth because other groups have blocked that stress response and you shut off the axon growth that normally happens.
Okay.
And we know that the neurons in our brain probably don't experience anything like that stress response after a spinal cord injury.
Right.
So from there, it's kind of clear what you have to do, right? You've got to find a way to mimic that stress response.
Right. You got to stress it out.
Yeah. You got to stress the neuron out, right? And this is really cool. There are tools to do that. There are genetic tools to trick a cell into activating these stress cascades.
Okay.
And so we started to do that. And so we started to take neurons that aren't injured at all, but treat them with these tools to make them think they've been injured.
Yeah.
And then we started to look at their gene activity afterwards.
Right.
And what we're seeing is massive changes in gene activity with a lot of the genes turned on, very reminiscent of the genes that are turned on by neurons that do successfully regenerate.
Wow.
So we've started to kind of mimic this, I don't know, the gene activity
right.
profile of a regenerating neuron. And we're just now starting to go where I'm sure you would want us to go, which is, okay, but are the axons actually growing better?
Right.
And we're starting to see hints that maybe the answer is yes with this artificial stress approach.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess my question then is, you know, let's say you just recently mentioned part of the reason it might not be getting that response initially is just how far away the injury is, right?
Yeah.
So is there a way that you can induce this stress but make it clear like this is where the stress is coming from? Or is it, you know, because if it's connected to all these other things, is it going to have these adverse effects for all of these systems that are still in good shape?
Yeah.
You know, like how do you say actually the stress is at this one point, not at all those other points?
Oh man, you already have a job, right? Do you want to come?
Well, I can guarantee I am not qualified to be in your lab in any shape or form.
I don't know. You are asking all the right questions. Exactly. You need a global grow signal,
mm-hmm.
and then you need a grow here signal,
right,
at the site of injury, right? And so, yeah, exactly. We're working on that in conjunction with the stress. You have to supply local signals right at the tip of the injured axon to tell the cell where to initiate the growth.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. So that's also where, part of it.
Yeah. Just not to circle too far back, but one of the things that's so exciting about these biomaterial approaches is that you cannot just put kind of a filler into the cavity. You can load that filler with signaling molecules to achieve what you were just saying, like, trigger the growth in a particular location.
Got it. And I'm assuming that is also probably some what I would call parallel research that's being done by other researchers in totally different fields from, you know, neurology and even spinal cord injury, that they're looking for that same thing where we want to specify where to do your changes kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. Well, I'm going to shift our gears a little bit. Your research is incredible. I'm, you know, extremely excited that you're seeing as much progress and breakthrough as you are. But I want to take a moment to kind of talk about on a global scale a little bit more, and even national scale, about research kind of as a whole. And I know, at least here in the United States, the government, you know, has talked about cutting back a little bit on research funding, kind of across the spectrum. Doesn't really matter which field you're in. But how has that specifically started to affect the SCI community?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I want to just make it clear to the, I don't know, to the listeners who may not be, you know, inside the game.
Yeah.
Just the scale of the cuts we're talking about.
Okay.
So some of these are already enacted and some of these are proposals. So let me just tick through. The Department of Defense used to fund spinal cord injury research. They had about a $40 million pool of money that was for spinal cord injury research, you know, to help injured veterans and so on.
Absolutely.
That's gone. That's done. That's a done deal. That is off the table, at least for next year and for the foreseeable future. So,
wow.
So there's one.
Yeah.
The proposal for the National Institutes of Health, which is the major funding of biomedical research, including spinal cord injury research.
Yeah.
40% cut.
Wow.
That's the proposal for next year. 40% less dollars. That's 18 billion fewer dollars on research than we spent last year.
Wow.
Yeah. On top of that, there's this, and this is where it gets like esoteric, but there's when the federal government gives my lab money,
right?
They give money to my lab, but they also give money to the university to kind of support the structure of research, the animal facilities and the maintenance costs and the people running HR, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
They're talking about like a 2/3 cut to that amount of money.
Wow.
So capping indirects, that's the term for it.
Yeah.
And then last but not least, like sort of separate from everything I just said, are these targeted cuts to specific institutions like Harvard and Columbia and so on.
Right.
And the way that's playing out is like funded labs just like mine have their grants frozen as of right now, like today.
Right.
Like there are spinal cord injury researchers that I know that are unable to go to work and do their research because their grants are frozen. They can't spend on their grants.
Right. Well, and I want to also kind of take this a step further to clarify for our audience. If you know anything about MCPF, we've always been really dedicated to kind of seed funding research. So new research projects that maybe don't have as much, results as what your team, your lab has accumulated at this point, but you have this idea and this idea really needs to get off the ground in order to go get the big money. And so that's really kind of where MCPF has played. But where it makes it really hard for us is donating to those things almost can feel like a moot point because by the time they get through the research that we funded, there is no money for them to go get. For the bigger project, once they have proof that this is like real, this is going to make a real difference in the world, there's no money for them to then go and continue that research on a broader scale. And I think that's what is really scary for organizations, even like us, you know, that we can continue to help researchers, but there's not really the end game for them, at this current state.
Right. So that's, I guess I went off almost on a tangent, but I just wanted to make sure people understand the scale of the cut we're talking about. We're not talking about a 5-10% cut. We're talking about a gutting of the research enterprise.
Right. And I think that it's also worth mentioning that's not just spinal cord injury research. That is research across the board.
Right.
Whether it's for cancer, whether it's for Alzheimer's, anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, you asked what the effect is. So there's obviously some of these are still proposals that Congress has to weigh in on. So there's still room. There's still time for some of this to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to make a point, though, which is So it puts scientists in a position of huge uncertainty right now, right?
Right.
Even if your grants aren't frozen, they might be in the future. Labs are basically small businesses. That's what they are. Mm-hmm. What does any small business do in the face of uncertainty, right?
Yeah.
They freeze. They hold.
Right.
Right. And so the immediate effects, and I've already seen this, it's happening in my lab, although I'm trying to resist it, and I see it in the labs that I talk to. Like, we're not hiring.
Right.
We're not talking about the next exciting idea. We're not innovating. We're not pushing like the next big idea.
Right.
We're holding. We're starting to play it really safe, right?
Right.
And that is like, that's the exact opposite of what you want.
Right.
You want risk taking. You want innovation. You want new ideas. And that is already like, that is shut down right now.
Yeah. So I mean, that kind of leads into my next question, where I'm assuming that's kind of the role that organizations like MCPF can help fill, is like helping kind of assist you in continuing to push that envelope.
Yeah.
So that you don't lose that step as we're in this turbulent time as far as research dollars are concerned.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, if your question is what does this mean for Morton and other foundations like it, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I'll just say it. The pressure is on, my friend.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how many grants you got last year, but you're going to get more next year, right?
Right.
More and more research labs are going to turn to you as the solution to all the problems I just laid out. I think it's, so first of all, let me say the positive, which is like, thank goodness you exist and other organizations like you. Like without,
right,
without you, like this situation would be completely untenable, right?
Mm-hmm.
At least there's like some hope of some other source of funding to sort of get us through what hopefully is a temporary problem.
Right.
The flip side of that is that there's no way you can take up all the slack on this.
Right.
Like it's a problem of scale. Like in the end, you're always going to be seed funding, and it's critical. Like we need seed funding. It plays this essential role in the ecosystem.
Right.
But if you germinate a seed and you drop it into a desert, like what's the point, right?
Exactly.
So, I don't know, get ready to review a lot more grants.
Well, I'm sure, Peter will be very happy to do that. That's, you know, I think a highlight for us is just getting to see all the different stuff that's going on, and your research included. But I guess my last question for today, and then we can wrap up. I know we're kind of pushing here on a bit of time, but, you know, for someone who might be watching this or listening or has a family member who's experienced a spinal cord injury and they're just as passionate as you are about finding that cure and regrowing that axon, what would you want them to understand about, you know, how best to support spinal cord injury research?
Right. All right. Number one is just never forget that a cure is possible. This can be done.
Mm-hmm.
There are too many examples in nature of nervous systems repairing themselves for us not to eventually reverse engineer our way to a solution. So we are going to get there. It's a question of time and resources and will.
Right.
And so don't get sucked into anyone who tells you that, first of all, that it can't be done or that we should settle for kind of partial treatments or dealing with only the consequences of the injury, not fixing the injury itself.
Right.
All of that. So just stay strong in the faith and believe that it can be done. That's the first thing I'd say.
Yeah.
Next thing I'd say is I'd go back to what I said earlier. This is a puzzle with a lot of pieces,
mm-hmm,
and there is no monotherapy. That's the hard part. There are too many components to the injury. There's a cavity and the neurons have to get ramped up and we've got to neutralize inhibition and on and on and on.
Right.
So there isn't a monotherapy here. There's going to be different pieces that eventually come together to start to look more like a cure.
Right.
And the effects of each one of those monotherapies is going to be smaller than we would like. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think epidural stimulation, which is, has all the press right now, it's definitely a piece of the cure. It's part of what the treatment is going to entail.
Well, and it's proving that if you're successful in your job, that it will work.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So allow each monotherapy to have its own little, probably smaller effects.
Yeah.
And keep the faith that when we start stacking these monotherapies into a combinatorial therapy, we're going to see much larger effects. And of course, that's a huge challenge because the whole system is set up for monotherapy, whether it's venture capital or the like governmental regulation.
Right.
It's all designed for monotherapies. And so we just have to have the patience and the faith and the continued support to work our way through the monotherapies to get to that combination that we need.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I think that pretty much covers all the questions I had here on my sheet. You know, I do want to take a moment and just on behalf of everyone here at MCPF and Spinalcast, you know, thank you for joining us on the podcast and all of your tireless efforts and work towards spinal cord injury is, you know, not only is it inspiring and incredible, but it is really important for the world as a whole. So we thank you for all of your efforts.
Yeah. And I want to thank you too. The, that stress idea that I'm so excited about, the cellular stress.
Yeah.
I should have said this when I was talking about it. The only reason we've been able to develop that idea is because of funding from Morton and two other private foundations. Like it's too early to get like the big government grants.
Yeah.
So that is all you and two other foundations kind of pooling together and allowing us to develop that idea in the first place. So keep doing what you're doing.
Awesome. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for that back, Pat. We appreciate it, you know?
Yeah.
So that's awesome to hear.
Yeah.
I do want to take a moment. Everybody who's watching on YouTube, you know, hit the subscribe button, like icon. All those things help us. If you're listening on your favorite podcast platform, you could always give us a follow. But again, Dr. Blackmore, thank you so much for joining us on today's podcast.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thanks. Bye.